From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a talk with the great soul and gospel singer Al Green about his life before and after he was born again. Also on this Labor Day, a talk with Studs Terkel about the irony of being a person celebrated for writing about the uncelebrated working man and woman. And book critic John Leonard reviews Thomas Gagin's new memoir about his work as a labor lawyer in an era when the labor movement sometimes seems like a lost cause. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet President Gorbachev and the leaders of 10 republics began today to maneuver a new plan of union through the Soviet Parliament. The plan calls for most of the central government's power to be shifted to the republics, which would be joined in a loose federation of sovereign states. The new federation plan was introduced by Gorbachev, Russian President Boris Yeltsin, and Kazakhstan President Nursultan Nazarbayev. The proposal didn't come to a vote before the full 1,900-member Congress of People's Deputies, but it won several key procedural votes by an overwhelming margin. The United States has joined the list of countries officially recognizing Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia as independent nations. President Bush made the long-expected announcement during a news conference in Kennebunkport today. Alan Dowd of Maine Public Broadcasting reports.
The president had delayed recognizing the Baltics in hopes that Soviet officials would first approve an independence agreement. A White House official said the president had expected to make the announcement last week, but the Soviets had asked for more time. The independence agreement still has not been approved, but the official said the president felt he could wait no longer. Mr. Bush downplayed criticism of his go-slow approach, saying the U.S. has always supported Baltic independence.
But when history is written, nobody's going to remember that we took 48 hours more than Iceland. Whoever else it is. But what's going to be remembered is what happens. How does it work out?
The president said diplomatic recognition requests from other breakaway republics would be handled on a case-by-case basis. For National Public Radio, I'm Alan Dowd in Kennebunkport.
Lithuanian President Vytautas Landsbergis reacted happily today to the announcement of U.S. recognition of Baltic independence. The republic's leader was in Hungary when the announcement came. Judith Ingram has more from Budapest.
The Lithuanian president and the three Baltic foreign ministers were in Budapest today to sign the protocols reestablishing diplomatic relations with Hungary. Landsbergis called the U.S. announcement the right step.
We waited for this resolution, this statement, and now all is going much better.
Estonian Foreign Minister Lennart Meri said the next step from the U.S. should be conclusion of trade agreements. The Hungarian parliament voted unanimously to recognize Baltic independence today. Hungary is the first country in the region to have formalized its recognition of Baltic independence with the reestablishment of diplomatic ties. For National Public Radio, this is Judith Ingram in Budapest.
Two ethnic Armenian regions in the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan declared themselves independent today. Moscow Radio said that the executive councils of the two regions voted to proclaim themselves the Nagorno-Karabakh Armenian Republic. Last week, Azerbaijan declared its independence from the Soviet Union. More than 800 people have been killed in clashes between ethnic Armenians and Azeris in the area. This is NPR News. Cemetery workers in Santiago, Chile, have begun opening unmarked graves that are believed to contain the remains of people killed after the 1973 military coup. The exhumations were ordered by a judge at the request of the Catholic Church's Human Rights Office. The military government of General Augusto Pinochet is accused of kidnapping, torturing, and killing more than 2,000 of its political opponents during its 16 years in power. Fighting has been reported in several parts of Croatia despite a ceasefire signed overnight by all six Yugoslav republics. Pierre Vickery reports that the violations had been expected since it takes some time for news of the ceasefire to reach outlying military units.
The heaviest fighting took place in Petrinja, a town 70 kilometers south of the capital, Zagreb. Units of the Yugoslav army fired tank shells, howitzers, and automatic weapons at buildings close to their barracks. The main telephone exchange was damaged and several houses were set on fire. Both the army garrison commander and the local head of the Croatian security forces claimed the other side had opened fire. Clashes also took place in Vukovar, Osijek and Okučani. Three people were killed by mortars, and a policeman died when his patrol car came under attack from automatic weapon fire. Meanwhile, the Austrian government has announced that it'll consider recognizing both Slovenia and Croatia as sovereign independent states at its cabinet meeting on Tuesday. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
A senior official of the scandal-ridden Bank of Credit and Commerce International has accused the Bank of England of incompetence and cover-ups. Masihur Rahman, a former chief financial officer at BCCI, told the London Observer that the British Central Bank was negligent in not discovering the fraud at BCCI. Rahman said that the Bank of England auditors tried to cover up their mistakes after the scandal began to break. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Al Green's ballads of the 70s were about as great as soul singing gets. But now when he sings about love, it's his love for the Lord. After becoming rich and famous with such hits as Tired of Being Alone and Let's Stay Together, Green was born again. In 1976, he was ordained and became the pastor of the Full Gospel Tabernacle in Memphis. By the end of the decade, he had virtually given up performing secular music and sang only gospel. My interview with him was recorded early this summer, just before he performed a concert of mostly gospel at Philadelphia's Academy of Music as part of the city's jazz festival. This is one of his recent gospel recordings.
Every day I'm gonna keep building up, sending timber up there every day. But I need the Lord to guide my feet and help me make it along the way. Up on my holy faith. I wanna keep building up.
Al Green, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, do you feel that it's still inappropriate for you to sing secular songs? Like some of your old greatest hits type of songs?
Well, I'm opening the show with L-O-V-E Love. Yeah, right. I'm opening the show with L-O-V-E Love. So we're going to go from there. I was doing a show the other week in Jackson, Mississippi on Capitol Street down in Jackson, Mississippi, and I must have lost my mind, went crazy or something. I sung Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Really?
By Otis Redding. So they said, Reverend Green is singing Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. Man, he is cool, man. So we just kept singing and having fun. I think if you sing songs to bring people together and magnify love instead of hatred, I think you might do okay.
Are there songs of yours that you won't sing now?
Yeah.
Which ones?
Well, I can't sing some songs because I wrote them because of I Love You, Baby, Darling, I Care for You. You know, I wrote them because of sensual love. I want to take you in my arms and sweep you off my feet, put you on a plane, go to a nice resort area with a cold bottle of champagne and kiss you. Mwah, 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 mwah. I wrote them because of that. And then, but now like Let's Stay Together, I wrote for couples because whether times are good or bad, happy or sad, whether we're right or wrong, forgiveness is in there. And we can always make up. That's always a lot of fun. And we can go on with our lives being what we're supposed to be.
Now, how do you feel when you hear your sensual secular songs on the radio?
I feel kind of funny, and then I kind of blush, you know, because I've spent so much time under the book now. And so when I hear some of those songs, I kind of blush, you know, and I go, did I actually say that? You know, here I am, come and take me. Well, I did it because of I was so flamboyant, and I was so kind of had an air of arrogance, you know. And I sung it because here I am, come and take me. You understand? And you know how that is. And so I learned to be more humble, more giving, more loving, and more understanding, you know. And that, yeah. So it's a little different, but still strong.
Well, Al Green, I'm going to play Let's Stay Together.
Let's play that.
Okay, here we go.
say it seems, baby, since we've been together, ooh, loving you forever.
That's my guest Al Green and his hit recording of Let's Stay Together. Do you remember how you met Willie Mitchell, who was the person who signed you to High Records and produced all the hits that you had with High?
Yeah, I remember how I met him.
How'd you meet him?
I met him in the country out in Midland, Texas, in Odessa, Texas, out there. I met him out there, and he asked me about going to Memphis to sing on a recording because he worked at a studio. And we were riding in the car that day, and I said, how long do you think it'll take me? I was so flamboyant. I don't understand how I did it. I was riding with this guy, and I says, how long will it take me to become a star? He says, and he swallowed like choked, right? He says, a star? Well, about 2 years probably if you really work at it. I said, excuse me, let me out. I don't have any kind of time. He says, you're not serious. I said, I'm serious. I don't have 2 years to waste on practicing to become a star. I need some money now. And really, so he took me down to High. He says, this kid's going to be phenomenal. They says, how do you know that? He says, because he's got it in him. And so he borrowed $1,500 for me from the president of the company to get me a place to stay and all that, and says, I want to work with him because he's going to be phenomenal. Just watch.
Gee, it really pays to have chutzpah, huh?
I guess. I just told him I wanted to be what I wanted to be.
Now the first song that he asked you to record was a cover of the Beatles' I Want to Hold Your Hand, right?
Would you believe that?
It really is hard to believe. Why did he choose that?
I have no idea.
What was your reaction to it?
My reaction was good. I thought it was a great song. It was a wonderful song, but it was for the Beatles. I sung I Want to Hold Your Hand. I sung Driving Wheel. We was trying to find Al Green. That's what we was trying to find. Who is this guy? Who is this guy with the high falsetto and the rough voice? And Willie says, I tell you what, don't sing with the rough voice. I said, well, what do you want me to do? He's cutting all these different songs about different people, just a lot of songs. He says, sing mellow. Don't sing hard. Sing mellow. And I just went out there and started singing, I'm so tired of being alone. And I'm so tired of on my own. Help me, girl, as soon as you can. And I looked in the studio mirror. They have this glass, right? And you're looking at the engineers. Yeah. And everybody was jumping up and jumping up and jumping up. And I says, well, I must be doing something right. So I just keep on saying, people say. And that's, I don't know how that started. That's the way it started.
Well, that was your song. It was a song you wrote. So you already had it written.
Yeah, I said, well, after we got done cutting all these other people's songs, the Beatles and all these blues songs and the Temptations, I Can't Get Next to You and all these songs, I says, I got a song too. So Willie says, oh, please. Because he'd been cutting all day. We'd been cutting all day. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. I says, I got me a song and I wrote it on my own. So Willie told one of the guys, go out there and see what he got, would you please? I got to have a drink. Willie had a little shot of vodka or something. And after he went to feeling better, he says, all right, what we got out here? And it was this song, Tired of Being Alone. And I worked it up with the band. And I sung it and it became our first million seller.
Well, I'm going to play it.
Let's play it. Come on. Let's play it.
This is Al Green's first big hit, a song he wrote, Tired of Being Alone.
Come back. Show me where it's at, baby. I'm so tired of being alone.
That's Al Green, my guest today, singing Tired of Being Alone. I want to get back to a story you were telling before we heard that about, you know, how you had to sing I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Yeah.
It's your first song. How did you sing that? I mean, what voice did you use?
I don't know. I just kind of sang, hey, you got that something that I think I understand. When I feel that something that I want to hold your hand. I want to hold your hand. Like that.
That sounds great.
I sung it in 71. That was 19 years ago.
Right. Right. So when you wrote Tired of Being Alone, were you alone? Were you tired of being alone?
Yeah, well, my girlfriend kept leaving me the key and leaving the apartment. And she would leave me a lot, and I was... And I says, well, how? It was snowing one night. It was snowing, and I had all the windows open because I was there by myself for hours on end. And I says, well, how can I do something with this? How can I make something out of this? And so I took a pencil and started writing it down because I was angry, and I was writing, I'm tired of being alone. I'm tired of on my own. Then I wrote several other things. I scratched those out, and I said, help me as soon as you can. And then I went to getting serious about it. People say that I found a way to make you say that you love me, which is I don't have to make you. If you really love me, you'd be here with me. And I was writing on that connotation. You didn't go for that. It's a natural fact. That, yeah, like that.
Had you written songs before?
Maybe one song before, that's all.
Oh, so this was something like newly discovered when you were recording this?
Yeah, everything was discovered at that time because we didn't have anything to, to no resources to kind of go back and say, I can do this or that.
Singer and preacher Al Green is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Like the bird in the sky. Oh, I can buy anything that money can buy. Oh, I can turn a river.
Al Green is my guest. One of the records that you made that was a cover of another recording was To Sir With Love.
Yeah.
And this had to be, like, when you saw the movie, you had to think of this as, like, a real corny song, right?
Yeah.
You had such a great version of it. Was it your idea to record the song?
I always wanted to record the song for years.
Why?
And I don't know. I heard this lady sing this song on a movie of something, some lady from England, and I heard this song. And I wanted to sing that song. And nobody was interested in letting me sing it. My producer says, come on, you don't want to sing it, Sir With Love. They would always figure out a way how to cut me off, you know. Well, let's everybody break, you know what I mean? So we never cut to Sir With Love. So I says, when I got my own studio, you know, after I came to the point where I wanted to sing gospel, everybody in Los Angeles and in L.A. says that's a bad idea. Everybody in Memphis said, oh, God, he's not going to try something else. I said, but I've got to sing gospel. I'm born again, and there's a lot of good that can be done from singing gospel as well. I went to my studio in Memphis, set up a studio, had Bill Cantrell to put it together, and recorded The Lord Will Make a Way, and all those Highway to Heaven and all those songs on that same album in a makeshift studio. And that was the pivotal point in the Al Green career of things. But since then, I've come to know Al Green. I've come to know myself better. I've come to know.
So you recorded To Sir With Love during that session?
Mm-hmm. During that time period, during the next two albums there, yeah. I cut it because I want to cut it so bad.
I'm going to play it.
Let's play it.
This is To Sir With Love, sung by my guest, Al Green.
The time has come for
The Reverend Al Green is my guest. There's a story about you that's kind of legendary in music lore. And I'm thinking of the story of the time a woman you were with poured hot grits or hot oatmeal or something
cream,
on it.
Cream of wheat.
on you while you were in the bath and scalded you and then took her life.
Yeah.
She killed herself afterwards. Is there a connection between that story and your being born again?
Nah, not whatsoever. People in journalism like to say that that was the reason, but I was born again in 73. This incident happened in 1974, so it really don't correlate, and they like to have it to be so that it correlates, but it doesn't. I was born again because they saw what I could be, not what I was. They knew what I was. I was a no good, woman hunting, champagne drinking, good time having, Saturday night, blues singing man. But they says, I'm not interested in what you are. What we're interested in is what you can be. And so I was born again on that premise.
How soon after you were born again did you become a minister?
I was born again in 73. I ran for 3 years trying to keep from becoming one, and I started a church in December 1976.
So when you became a minister and started a church, did you have the church built? Was it a building that already existed, or did you have it built?
No, I was in a hurry. I went and bought the church. The time I saw it, I says, didn't make no difference what church it was. My mind was in such a turmoil. I was a star. I could go anywhere. People know you. But I was spiritually so turmoil. I was in a suite, in the best suite in the house, a presidential suite in Holiday Inn, Rivermont, in Memphis, upstairs, praying in the middle of the floor with a preacher. I needed to go and do what I, it was time for me to do what I needed to do. So when I went out, I went to the office the next Monday morning, there was a preacher came by. He says, are you Al Green? I said, yeah. He said, I was sent over here to talk to you. I said, by who? So he says, you want to start singing, start preaching? I said, yeah, let's go find a church. We went and looked on the market and found a church. I took out a check out of my pocket right out of here, bought that building. The next Sunday, we had church.
So you paid for it from money that you made as a music star.
Right, just like that.
Since you were a star, and you still are a star, but, I mean, when you started the church, people knew you as Al Green, you know, soul singer.
Yeah.
Did you have a lot of people showing up, especially early on?
Yeah.
Just to hear Al Green
still
sing?
Still do. Yeah.
So how much do you sing in the church?
I sing quite a bit, but when they come, I also drop the bomb. Yeah. That's it.
You don't let them off easy.
No. I catch them with that voice, and I hold them with that voice, and then I tell them and they wind up agreeing with me.
Do a lot of people, including record producers, try to talk you into making secular records again?
Yeah.
And do you ever consider it?
They tried to talk me into it the other day, yeah. I consider it.
So tell me, now we're recording this on a Thursday.
Okay.
And the day after we record this, you're going to be performing at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia.
Okay, let's go.
Now, at the Academy of Music, are you gonna be preaching at all to you?
No, I don't preach when I go out to do concerts. When I go to do concerts, you go to do concerts. You go to do revivals, then you preach. When you go to sing, you go to sing. There's some things that make just beautiful sense. Now, I may say some things, but I'm not going to preach. No. You come to do a concert, you do the concert. So we're going to do the concert.
Al Green, it's really been a pleasure to meet and talk with you. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, dear.
Singer and preacher Al Green, recorded in June of this year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Love and happiness. Yeah. Something that can make you do wrong, make you do right. Yeah. Love.
Love and happiness. But wait a minute, something's going wrong. Someone's on the phone, 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, talking about how she can make it right. Yeah, yeah. Happiness is when you really feel good about somebody. There's nothing wrong being in love with someone. Yeah. Oh, baby, love and happiness.
Love and happiness.
Love and happiness.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Studs Terkel has contributed to contemporary American history by recording the stories of working men and women. Coming up, a talk with Terkel about his own work. And book critic John Leonard reviews the memoir of a young labor lawyer. It's called Which Side Are You On? Trying to Be for Labor When It's Flat on Its Back. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. All three republics are pleased with the U.S. decision to recognize the Baltics. Leaders had been critical of the administration for taking so long to do so. Julian Borger, reporting for the BBC, has reaction from the Estonian capital, Tallinn.
President Bush's statement caused considerable relief in the Baltic states, whose governments had become increasingly nervous over the delay in announcing the decision. The Lithuanian president, Mr. Vytautas Landsbergis, speaking in Vilnius, said it would mean the greatest possible protection against every possible new aggression. The Latvian president, Mr. Anatolis Gorbunovs, said in Riga that the decision made independence irreversible. While in Tallinn, the prominent Estonian nationalist, Mrs. Mariju Loristin, said she hoped that it would influence the Congress of People's Deputies meeting in Moscow, which is yet to consider Soviet recognition of the Baltic states. Until then, Baltic officials say there can be no progress in talks with Moscow on the withdrawal of the hundreds of thousands of Soviet troops stationed in the three republics.
Julian Borger reporting. In Moscow today, Soviet President Gorbachev and leaders of 10 Soviet republics presented a plan to the parliament to prevent the total collapse of the Soviet Union. NPR's Anne Gerrels has this report.
The plan reflects demands by the republics for greater powers. It calls for the signing of a new union treaty under which each republic would decide how closely it wishes to participate. In the meantime, the proposal suggests the complete dismantling of the current parliamentary system, which would be replaced by transitional structures, a council of representatives made up of 20 delegates from each participating republic, a state council of Gorbachev with Republican leaders, and an inter-republican economic committee. After a recess, the leadership of the 10 republics basically supported the plan, though they had some reservations and questions were raised about the roles of the new government, responsibility for the military, and the management of the economy. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
The largely Armenian-populated region of Nagorno-Karabakh today declared itself independent of the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan. The region has been the scene of bloody ethnic clashes over the past 3 years. The region now calls itself the Nagorno-Karabakh Armenian Republic. Its executive council declared the Soviet constitution and laws in force there, making it clear that it has a wish not to participate in last week's decision by Azerbaijan to secede from the Soviet Union. More than 800 people have died in clashes between ethnic Armenians and Azeris. Nagorno-Karabakh declared itself part of the neighboring Republic of Armenia in 1988, but neither Soviet authorities nor the Azerbaijan government recognized that declaration. Wall Street is closed today. In Tokyo, the Nikkei average closed up for the third straight day, while in London, British shares leaped to record closing prices. This is NPR News. Romanian President Ion Iliescu arrived today in Israel for a 3-day visit, the first by a Romanian president to the Jewish state. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem that Israel will formally object to what is considered anti-Semitic propaganda in the Romanian press.
Among Eastern European countries, Romania has a unique position for Israel. It's the only East Bloc country that did not sever ties with Israel at the time of the Six-Day War in 1967. Israeli planes have flown to Bucharest for years and Israeli merchant ships dock at Romanian ports. Jews in Romania have long enjoyed full legal rights. Jewish education has flourished, and Romanian Jews were freely allowed to emigrate to Israel long before their brethren in neighboring Eastern European countries. But officials in Jerusalem have voiced concern about the efforts of some elements in Romania to rehabilitate the memory of the wartime dictator Ion Antonescu, who was responsible for the deaths of 300,000 Jews. Officials also point to some blatant anti-Semitic articles in two Romanian newspapers. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Today in London, auditors at Price Waterhouse rejected criticism of their role in uncovering fraud at the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. They said the law prevented them from making all the facts public at this stage. The former chief financial officer at BCCI called the Bank of England grossly negligent in failing to detect and prevent widespread fraud at BCCI. He also accused the auditors of incompetence. Meanwhile, Hong Kong's High Court today approved a conditional sale of the local arm of BCCI to the Lippo Group, based in Indonesia. One court official said the agreement with Hong Kong Chinese Bank, a Lippo subsidiary, is not legally binding. He noted that if this agreement fails, the BCCI branch will be liquidated. The Hong Kong government closed the BCCI branch last July. The closure shook Hong Kong, and depositors made runs on local branches of four other banks, including Citibank and British-based Standard Chartered. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. George Gershwin is far better known as a composer than as a performer, but in the 1920s and 30s he made a number of recordings of both his popular and more serious works. All of them have now been released on a 2-CD set on the British Pearl label. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz doesn't think anyone ever played Gershwin better than Gershwin.
On February 12, 1924, George Gershwin made musical history at New York's Aeolian Hall. That was the world premiere of his Rhapsody in Blue. Paul Whiteman conducted, and Gershwin himself played the piano. 4 months later, they recorded it for Victor. It was Gershwin's first commercial recording. 3 years later, with the advent of electrical recording, the original performers recorded it again. Both versions are now available on a new collection called George Gershwin Plays George Gershwin. It's fascinating to compare them because there were bigger changes than in the recording technique. Ferdy Grofe, who is best known as the composer of the Grand Canyon Suite, was Paul Whiteman's orchestrator. He helped arrange the original Rhapsody in Blue. Before the second recording, he made changes in the orchestration, added more instruments. Over the years, Rhapsody got more and more respectable, more Rhapsody and less blue. In 1942, 5 years after Gershwin's death, Grofe made an even more symphonic arrangement. Here's the way Rhapsody in Blue opened in the original 1924 version. Ross Gorman is the amazing clarinetist. This is what the same personnel sounded like in 1927. The sound is better, but already Rhapsody in Blue has begun to sound more big band than jazz band. George Gershwin didn't make a lot of commercial recordings. Besides the two complete versions of Rhapsody in Blue and a separate version of the Andante, the only other serious works of his that he recorded are his brief three preludes and the even briefer piano and celeste parts on a recording of An American in Paris conducted by Nat Schildkret. He also supervised an album of selections from his opera Porgy and Bess with two Metropolitan Opera singers, Helen Jepsen and the great Lawrence Tibbett. Both white, of course. All of these, plus excerpts from two live Gershwin radio appearances on the Rudy Valley Show, are all included in this new CD set. But the selections that you might play most often are the 10 rhythmically exhilarating solo recordings Gershwin made in London of his own inimitable arrangements of his show tunes. Songs like Someone to Watch Over Me, My One and Only, and Clap Your Hands, which we heard at the very beginning. Gershwin also accompanied the sublime Fred Astaire and his sister Adele in four other numbers, and they're all irresistible.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed George Gershwin plays George Gershwin on the Pearl label.
I don't shake and suck my bar. Each morning I get up with the sun.
This is Fresh Air. Perhaps no American has done more to bring to life the stories of working men and women than Studs Terkel. So on this Labor Day, we're going to hear Terkel talk about his own work. And to do it, we go into the archives back to 1985. Studs Terkel records stories of American life by letting Americans speak for themselves. His best-selling books of oral history include Working, about life on the job, Hard Times, Memories of the Great Depression, and The Good War, about World War II. Studs Terkel also hosts a syndicated radio interview show which originates in his hometown, Chicago. There he uses his interviewing skills for prompting insights and anecdotes from more celebrated personalities. To his readers and listeners, the 79-year-old Terkel has become a folk figure in his own right. I asked him if he has different approaches for interviewing famous and uncelebrated people.
No, it's the same. Naturally, when someone wrote a book, I got to read the book. And that takes time. Now, I interview a person, the non-celebrated person, so-called, it's to find out what that person is thinking, but you're exploring new territory. I say I'm like Columbus discovering a new land, and that this person has never been asked about her life before. And that person opens up, and a marvelous thing happens sometimes. And these are those great occasions when that person, in the days when the tape recorder was not as ubiquitous as it is now, that person, hey, could you play that back? I want to hear my voice. And the kids are around her, and you play it back, and that person says, you know, I never knew I felt that way before. Not I never knew I thought, I never knew I felt that way before. It's a tremendous moment of revelation for that person, and of course for me too. I'm kind of like a fellow passenger on a trip, in a way.
How far will you push, though, when you're doing a personal interview? Because some people really want to get someone to confide all their secrets and to break down and cry and reveal
mine's exactly
these
the
deep
opposite.
Emotional things.
No, mine's exactly the opposite. I never trespass on what I think is private domain of a person. But the person is telling me something that reveals a facet of a life. And it's personal, but it only because it reveals a facet of a life. That's a different thing. But just not gossip. No time for that. I'll tell you a story, okay? Years ago, I was interviewing Diana Barrymore. Diana Barrymore was the daughter of the great actor John Barrymore, and she died a number of years ago. Diana Barrymore, at that time, was the subject of Scandal magazine. It was a horrible magazine called Confidential. And they go into her sex life, bizarre, her junkiness, her drinking. And it's just... Then she acts in a Tennessee Williams play, suddenly last summer in Chicago. And she's wonderful. She was a marvelous actress in this play, the girl who was lobotomized. Later on, she did Maggie in Cat on a Hot Tin. So after seeing her in the Tennessee Williams play, I interviewed her, and we're talking about Tennessee Williams, the heroines, what they mean to her. And then we finished the interview, and it's rather good, I thought. She said, haven't you forgotten something? I said, well, I've forgotten a lot of things. What? You haven't asked me those questions. I said, what questions? Well, those questions about my life, you know, that everybody else asks. I said, none of my business. I says, nor the business of the reason. I wanted to find out about you through your artistry, through your craft. If I had Frank Lloyd Wright on, the architect, would I ask him about his wives, whom he left, or left him, or I ask about his architecture and why the Imperial Hotel withstood the Japanese earthquake, you know. And so when you're asked you how you attack this girl, the role, and then she busts out crying. She says, no one has ever said that to me before. She came to accept that as in the normal way of things, to accept humiliation. Well, I don't do it. Serves no purpose. I don't do none of my business. That's like peeking through a keyhole or peeking through a transom. And, of course, I resent that very much. So the person tells me of his life with something involving that makes it universal. That's it. It's when somebody reads this, that happened to me. I thought the same thing. That's what I look for. A certain universality in a specific.
Do you think your interviewing's gone through different stages? You know, is the way you interview now the way you started when you began
interviewing? I don't know. Gee, I can't. I think it's different. I think I've gotten older and more of a easier way, I think. I'm not sure. I think you learn as you go along. You learn different people. But you still have to go round and round and round the mulberry bush. I mean, you're still, it's a conversation, and then rather than interview. Because sometimes I say something about myself maybe, too, if it helps, you know. Very often, you know, here's a tale out of school. I'm not very good mechanically. You know, I use the tape recorder, right? The tape recorder is my right arm. And I don't know how it works. You know, I can't drive a car. So I goof up a lot, unintentionally. That person helps me, the person I'm interviewing. And when that person helps me, something happens. That person feels needed by me. And to feel needed is terribly important. Many people don't feel needed, you see. So there's no one way. I clown around, horse around. And
so it's important for you to not be the star when you're interviewing somebody, not the famous Studs Terkel interviewing
somebody. No, well, you see, that becomes, I got to watch that, you see. Isn't that funny? You said the famous Studs Terkel. This is a guy who is in a half-assed way sort of celebrated for interviewing non-celebrated people, which is ironic, is it not, you know? If I took that seriously, I'd be a real oaf, wouldn't I, and a clod. Maybe I am, but I don't take it seriously, no.
In your memoir, Talking to Myself, you talk about a scene in the movie Five Easy Pieces. Why don't you share impressions of that? Because that's such a classic scene, love what you have to say about it.
Five Easy Pieces. I know young listeners love this movie, and it was a good, slick movie. I say slick. And it was very good. It just happened. Before seeing, I interviewed a waitress for the book Working. I remember her name. She's now dead. She was a wonderful woman named Yolanda Leaf. I call her Dolores Dante in the book. Now and then change her name. But in almost every case, I say, we should use my real name. I do it maybe because they might be embarrassed, but they weren't. Anyway, so I view this. She's describing her daily work, a waitress, her work. And then I see the movie. And the key scene in that movie, the one they use all the time in the Academy Awards, is this virago. Here's Jack Nicholson. I'm not blaming him. I'm talking about the character. This guy's going to go to Alaska. He's a great piano virtuoso. And my feeling is, go ahead. I'm not stopping you. You want to go to Alaska? Go ahead. You're a pretty dull guy, you know? I mean, this is the self-indulgence. I'm talking about the character. And he's there with these companions in this restaurant. And here comes the villain, the waitress, the virago. And soon she comes on, you know, she's a wrongo. She looks at what he throws the menu down. He's, could I have a change? I forget the exact scene. But they want a substitution. There's no substitution. Sorry. And she's behaving so bad that he throws the stuff on the floor. And the kids in the audience, seeing the film, stood up and they cheered. And I'm saying, you little so-and-sos, you don't know who this waitress is. This is a setup. Is she tired? How are her varicose veins? Waitresses get a lot of varicose veins. So do stewardesses on planes. You know what? How many bufferins did she take? Why is she a waitress? The husband left her. He's dead. He's sick. Kids in trouble. And did she have? How tired is she? Did she have a fight with the chef just then behind the doors? They know nothing about her other than they cheered when he was showing her up. Well, I was so furious about that because it tells those kids, these people who work aren't much. These are the same yuppies today on the campuses. They know nothing. Nothing about history or the nature of life, you know. And so I was so furious. Well, Working taught me, yeah. It taught me. I'm impatient a lot with a telephone operator. No, I know what a telephone operator's life is like. But the great reward comes when I get a letter now and then from somebody. Or this was a young priest walking along the Michigan Avenue Bridge teaching at a school, at a seminary. And he says, you know, my kid said to me, on reading Working, he had Working assigned, they'll never again talk to a waitress the way they did before, or they'll never again talk to a truck driver the way they did. Well, that's good stuff. That's a reward, yeah. If it can alter a person's attitude, a book, well, you got something.
In your book, Working, you interviewed a lot of people who had 9-to-5 jobs that they did and that were hard, but it wasn't a kind of like life's work to them. For some it was, but I mean, for some of the people, they were like waitresses and wished that they didn't have to do it. You've had the opportunity to have a kind of life's work that is very meaningful to you. Yeah. Do you consider that like a great gift to be able to do that?
It's a fortune, good fortune. For me, it's good fortune. Because imagine the great many people are doing work of which they don't see the end result. You see, the guy who's a spot welder in a plant, in contrast to the old cabinet maker, makes the whole thing. But also, see, remember, Freud, in Civilization Discontents, spoke of work Leben und Arbeiten, love and work, or sex and work, as the two prime impulses of human beings. And so there were a lot of books about sex, but very few about work at the time working came out, you know. And so that was the dirty little secret, dirty big secret, work. D.H. Lawrence called sex dirty little secret. But work was the dirty big secret, because work is an extension of a person. And if that work is meaningless, the person's life becomes meaningless, you see. And so talking about work became terribly important to a great many people.
Studs Terkel, from an interview we recorded in 1985. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. Coming up on our program, the news that President Bush has announced American formal diplomatic recognition of the independence of the three Baltic republics, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. And we'll be hearing from NPR's Michael Sullivan in Vilnius, the Lithuanian capital, about the rather blasé reaction there, both from the government and from the men in the street. We'll also be hearing from Ann Garrels about the debate in Moscow over new relations between the central government and the Soviet republics. And on this Labor Day, a talk with populist Jim Hightower about why things are actually looking up for the labor movement. Those stories are coming up on All Things Considered today from National Public Radio.
On this Labor Day, our book critic John Leonard has a review of a new memoir by labor lawyer Thomas Gagan. It's called Which Side Are You On? Trying to Be for Labor When It's Flat on Its Back.
Thomas Gagan is an attorney in Chicago. He went to Harvard College and Harvard Law in the 1960s. He's read everything, from Dante to the Book of Kells, from the Elizabethans to Carlos Castaneda, from Nietzsche to Orwell. And he likes the good things in life. When I first saw Hyde Park, he says, I felt like a sailor seeing land, the brick townhouses, the bookstores, the BMWs. This looked like the kind of place where a Saul Bellow would find a plot. He goes to wine bars, eats carrot cake, and jogs. I could pass, he says, as a management lawyer, but I am not. I belong to another world, too. It is the black, sulfurous, White Sox anti-world, the South Side, the secret world of organized labor. Gagan went to work for organized labor just when organized labor was dying. Always he threw in his lot with the losing side, the dissidents, the Yablonsky faction of the United Mine Workers, trying to get rid of the murderous Tony Boyle, the Sadlowski forces trying to reform the United Steel Workers, the carpenter locals trying to save themselves from an extortionist international, the Teamsters for a Democratic Union trying to rescue themselves from the mob. He left Chicago once for the Carter administration, just in time to see his national energy plan shot down. And he left again, after spending 7 years to save the pension rights of some steelworkers everybody else disdained, for Paris and some existential brooding. But even in Paris, his heart stayed home. Sitting on the Saint-Germain-des-Prés, he says, I'd sometimes think about South Chicago and how everything that changes the world or breaks our hearts must always start out from a secret city. Which side are you on? His memoir of his secret cities is at least three different books. One is the sad and funny tale of a yuppie gone wrong, conscience afflicted, liberal guilty, anachronistic. Another is a horror story of big labor in its dying gasp, undemocratic and indifferent to the rank and file. A third, the most important, is a furious indictment of labor laws, from Taft-Hartley to Landrum Griffin, and the courts, and the Congress, and of course the Reagan Revolution, all of which have ganged up to make it impossible for unions to organize, much less strike, and make it equally impossible for individual workers to get justice from the company, the courts, or their own union. Nor is Gagan much impressed by a post-industrial American capitalism that no longer reinvests or innovates. America, he says, sometimes seems like the third or fourth generation of the Buddenbrooks family in the Thomas Mann novel. Nobody wants to go into the old family business because it is too hard, too much trouble, and nobody really believes in it. We want to go into real estate and cappuccino. There are two other books Gagan might have written, on class in America, and on labor history before the 1930s, back when socialism was not a dirty word. But what we do have is a memoir so angry and witty and trenchant that it might actually change the way we think, not to mention saving the soul of a bankrupt Democratic Party for which the workers used to vote.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Which Side Are You On? By Thomas Gagan. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Weinstein. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Are you overcome by anxiety every time you think about your personal finances? On the next Fresh Air, personal finance expert Jane Bryant Quinn gives us some advice on how to save a little, invest a little, and keep it simple. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.